This is episode number 785 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about some of the upcoming cons we're going to, Marvel's Legacy event, Mile High Comics skipping San Diego Comic-Con, and the new Onyx Path Kickstarter. Our comics this week will be Giant Days number 28, Simpsons number 239, and Cable number 1. And our summer reading project continues this week with more case files from the Judge Dredd Compendium. We're going to go through Don Uggie and the Ape Gang through the Futsy storyline. And this week's creator spotlight is author, writer, and game designer Monica Valentinelli, who I spoke to recently about the new Kickstarter project that she is doing with Onyx Path called Chronicles of Darkness, Dark Eras 2.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
And welcome, everybody, to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing very good. Beautiful weather.
Beautiful weather.
Finished my first week of vacation.
I know.
Got another one coming up, and I am really...
Hopefully people heard that last week on the show,
yeah,
that you are in the midst of a sabbatical.
I am enjoying the laziness of life. This is a lot of fun.
You got some color. I noticed you spent some time out in the sun,
yeah,
maybe a little out in the pool.
Pretty much in the pool. I don't lay out in the sun, but if the sun is there when I'm in the pool, which it is, I'll do that. But I do have to mention what a really fun time I had, me and my wife had, with you and your wife last weekend. The first time in 15 years.
The first ever Secret Identity Podcast double date.
Yes. First time we ever did anything
We should have
together.
Made an episode out of it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've been like at birthday parties and stuff before. You guys have had events over here where we've been here before. But this was the first time that we actually, A, went out to dinner.
Yep.
And then B, went out to do some sort of an activity afterwards.
Yeah.
And we went to see a band called Beyond Purple.
Yep.
Who your buddy Jimmy Bell plays guitar in.
And BJ Zampa, the drummer.
Yep. Over in by Lake Congamon.
Yes.
In Southwick, Massachusetts at the...
The Cove.
The Cove. Is that what it's called now?
Yep.
It used to be called... What did it used to be called? We just talked about that.
Because Sophia was saying... She goes, oh, I remember. I used to come here when it was the...
I want to say it was the Brass Rail.
That's what I think it was.
I believe that's what it used to be called, but a local hall, basically, that we went and saw the band at. But you're absolutely right. It was a fantastic time. Like, you and I have been on so many dates, just the two of us.
Yes.
Whether it's, you know, three-hour-long car rides to New York or whether, you know, all the different stuff that we've done over the years. But it was really cool to be able to hang out with the wives, and it was just great. It felt very comfortable and made us sit there and wonder like why we hadn't done this before and when we can do this again. And so that was really nice. That was a great time.
And maybe we'll be doing it again tomorrow as we record this for your birthday.
Yes, because tomorrow is the release of Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yep.
And I was thinking about that today because people were saying, oh, well, it's getting good ratings on the, you know, the Rotten Tomatoes and all that kind of stuff. And I said, I don't even pay attention to that because to me, I rate it on the Raimi scale. That's all that matters to me. I will rate that according to the Raimi scale. You know, for me, Spider-Man 1 and 2 will always be at the top of my list because especially the first one, which I know people would not put that at the top of their list. For me, it is because to me, when Sam Raimi put Peter Parker and Spider-Man up on that stage, up on the screen, the heart and soul of that movie established what I wanted
from
Spider-Man. Now, I've heard very similar things about this new Spider-Man movie. And after seeing Tom Holland in Civil War, I mean, I could not be more excited for this movie. I would love nothing more than to say this is my favorite Spider-Man movie of all time. I just don't know how you're going to top Spider-Man 1 in terms of the emotional impact that it had on me. But I'm so excited for it. I was going back and watching the old Electric Company Spidey Super Stories episodes on YouTube today where Morgan Freeman was narrating the comic book interspersed with live action, which those things are really awesome. And there was a bunch of them that got put out on a DVD set a few years ago. But what I did not realize, and shame on me, is that there was like a 52-issue comic book run of Spidey Super Stories that I immediately went on eBay and saw, and there are no complete runs anywhere that I have found in terms of like people just selling off the entire run. But a lot of those issues seemed reasonably priced, like I could get them. So I kind of felt a little Holy Grail kind of quest coming on of those, because they were aimed at ages 6 to 10 and the goal was to get kids reading. And that's what I loved about the actual segments on Electric Company, is Spidey never spoke.
Yeah, he went, and then it would be the word bubbles
because they wanted to get kids reading. And that was super cool. And then all the cast members of Electric Company would play the different characters in the strip, which was interspersed with like comic book panels. So obviously they didn't have the budget to have a big knockdown, drag out fight between Spider-Man and the Spoiler, which was what the first one was. So they'd show it in comic book form.
Yeah.
And then they just show the aftermath with Spidey there and stuff like that. But super cool. Anything Spider-Man related, I'm really nostalgic for that stuff now. And of course, very excited to see that movie. So
the Spidey Super Stories run was amazing. And I was not a Spider-Man fan, never read the comics growing up. But I used to get those because there was something cool about them. They also were, where the regular comics were 30 cents, these were 35. They had no ads in them. And I remember on the corner, they used to have like a little easy reader because the comic book was easy reader approved.
Right.
So a lot of fun those books were. I do believe our good friend, now I just completely blanked on his name, Jim. Why am I drawing?
Taylor?
No. Oh boy. Why am I doing that? I cannot.
Of course, I will edit this part out.
What's his face? I can't believe I forgot it. Oh my gosh, that's what we were talking about, being old.
Salakrup?
Jim Salakrup, thank you.
Okay, well, all right. I do believe our good friend. Go ahead.
Yes. So our good friend Jim Salakrup had something to do with those books as well.
Yes.
Because I do believe my number one is autographed by him.
That wouldn't surprise me. That's probably right up on his shelf next to the Toxic Avenger comic that he did over at Marvel as well. So, and anytime we can get a plug in for Jim Salakrup and the work that he does, go check out Paper Cuts, by the way. We are more than happy to do so. So, yeah, super, super excited about that stuff. Also excited, Matthew, about some of the conventions that we're going to be attending this summer. And, of course, Plastic City Comic Con, as we are in July right now, is coming up on July 29th, 2017 at the Wallace Civic Center in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. 10 to 6, kids 12 and under free, adults $2.
Yeah, $2.
And I like to think that admission price was set because Keith was inspired by the movie Better Off Dead.
He probably was, $2.
Yep. I'm sorry, Ricky, I don't have a dime.
Yep.
Didn't ask for a dime.
$2.
$2. So anyways, guests, Jerry Ordway, Joe Caramagna, Sean Wong, Chris Gugliotti, Jay May, Kat Cusio, George O'Connor, HB Comics Brothers, and more going to be there. And of course, us, we are very much looking forward to that. And of course, Keith and Amy, who are putting the whole thing on, very excited for that show.
Going to be a lot of fun.
And then, of course, in August, we have the 18th through the 20th, we will be at Mohegan Sun in Uncasville, Connecticut for Terrificon 2017. The guest list. Redonkulous.
Yes.
Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo, George Perez, Marv Wolfman, Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatteis, Kurt Busiek, Stan Sakai, Peter David, Chris G. Russo, and that's just on the comic book side, and that's only half of them.
Yep.
Dean Cain, Finn Jones, Echo Kellum, Violet Bean, Shannon Purser on the celebrity side of things. I mean, just unbelievable. And of course, panels are being sort of put together now, and we know some of the panels that we'll be involved with at the show.
Yeah, so I have a little list of the ones. And right now, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 of them over the course of the weekend. We'll have you and I hosting them on a Friday, 3 o'clock, Podcasting 101 with you, Brian. At 4 o'clock, I'm doing Marvel in the 70s.
Marvel in the 70s,
which is going to be interesting because that looks like a lot of the focus is going to be on some of the off characters like Howard the Duck, Nova, the things like that.
And you were in your 20s during that time, so that was a time where you were really involved in the comic scene.
At 6 o'clock on Friday with Roy Thomas, I will be celebrating Jack Kirby's 100th birthday.
That's awesome.
Which I'm looking forward to that one. On Saturday, there's a Spider-Man 55th panel with you, Kraven's Last Hunt.
Which is
That's with
Mike
Zeck.
Number one with a bullet. I cannot wait for that panel.
245 on a – I'm sorry, 215 on a
Will
Saturday.
Will Mr. DeMatteis be on that panel? I'm sure.
I don't see – I didn't see him on there. Now at 5 o'clock, I'm doing another Jack Kirby 100 years celebration talking about his cartoon work.
I love it.
And that is going to be a lot of fun. Marty Pasco and Paul Kupperberg are going to be on the panel with me on that one. The Justice League celebrating 30 years, 6:15 on Saturday. The Punisher with you.
And who is our guest on that panel?
That looks like I can't even read. Mike Zeck.
Uh-huh.
And I can't read my other writing on the other one.
Guest to be named later when Matt
when I can read my writing
transcribes his handwriting.
And then Sunday at 10:45, you have Astro City with Kirk Busiek. And then at 3 o'clock on Sunday, Maddie spends an hour with Stan Sakai,
which is you have done a Stan Sakai panel in the past,
and I was terrified the entire time because I just love this guy.
Yes, yes, that'll be great. So stay tuned for more details and more information about that stuff. So we have some exciting cons coming up. Let's talk a little bit about Marvel Legacy. You know, you mentioned Kirby's 100th birthday, which, of course, Marvel and DC are both celebrating. Marvel is on the cusp of a very big event, and we have heard at this point that it's going to be the Legacy event. Marvel has revealed new elements of its Legacy initiative, Matthew, which will kick off with a Legacy number one one-shot that leads into the series renumbered according to Legacy numbering. So, as you might have heard before, and I think we talked about on a previous episode, they are going back to Legacy numbering for their big books.
Which I wish they would.
Which is what DC did.
DC did that with Action.
With Detective Comics,
with Detective,
right?
And Action Comics.
Marvel promises that the one-shot is a setup for 53 Marvel Universe series, Matthew. 53. The first 52 labeled Marvel Legacy story arcs have been revealed in a graphic, which we've helpfully cut into four, blah, blah, blah. Marvel pulled the biggest of big guns from its marketing arsenal and has released an endorsement from none other than Marvel Chairman Emeritus Stan Lee, who said of the Legacy Initiative, "I love the concept of returning to the classic characters as they were originally portrayed without losing the brilliance and excitement of Marvel's newest generation of heroes." And of course, he added Excelsior just for punctuation. Other reveals in the announcement, the new issues will be clean jumping on points and will be identified with new trade dress. Heroes will fight villains. Okay.
Perfect.
Marvel is going all in. The Legacy number one storyline sets the stage for the coming years of Marvel storytelling. Marvel is also marketing new issues aggressively. It recently announced that it will be giving away free copies of Marvel previews promoting the new issues. So this is the big event. This is the big Marvel. It's not a reboot, but it kind of is a reboot.
Yeah. Don't call it a reboot.
Yeah, don't call it a reboot. So, I mean, I don't know that we've spent a lot of time talking about Legacy. I'm always interested to see what they do, but not overly excited for what's going on.
Interesting that you talked about you're going to see superheroes fighting supervillains. Let's think about that statement for a little bit. Think about Marvel and how they really haven't been fighting bad guys lately. It really seems to be Captain America is fighting his own legacy, the world, and everything else. You've got Civil War, which was a political event.
Right. I mean, without them saying in here, back to basics.
Yeah.
It's clearly the initiative is back to basics.
The villains are what really sells the books. That was a big thing when I discovered Captain America as a kid. It was picking up 212 that had the Red Skull on it. Then 213 had the Night Flyer, and then 214 was Arnim Zola. So
right.
It was just like one crazy thing after another where you knew you were going to get capped, but it was like, who's he going to fight next episode? Who's he going to fight? Who's he going to fight?
Yep.
Let's get back to that, please.
Well, and I mean, a lot of it to me just goes back to the same thing. Like, just tell good stories.
Yes.
If you're telling good stories, you don't need to reboot everything. You don't need to do all of that stuff. And there's been some really interesting articles lately that I've been reading about sort of our buddy Daryl Taylor linked. If you go to the TaylorPodcastNetwork.com, you can see an article that he linked to that I forget who wrote it, but it was about from the retailer's perspective, like what's going on and how Marvel has kind of fudged things up over the past couple of years. And this cycle that they're in of sort of rebooting and stuff like that isn't really helping. And in some ways, DC has done the same things over there. I think that the industry is changing very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And these traditional models are really struggling to figure out a path to success with the changing landscape. And so you're seeing just a lot of throwing stuff against the wall and seeing if it sticks. You know, 6 months into Legacy, a year into Legacy, if that's not going well, there'll be another, you know, kind of reboot. And same similarly with DC. If Marvel comes out and blows the doors off with their new Legacy event and DC starts really falling behind, then you're going to see them do something drastic in order to try to make up that ground. And I wish they would get out of that arms race.
Yeah.
So that they can just, because I like where DC is going right now. Perhaps this will put Marvel on a path that will be pleasing to the majority of fans that are reading it. I'm happy with the books I'm reading, and I don't care about the rest of the larger Marvel universe. I have my own little spider world that I pay attention to and some fringe books that I pick up, and I'm okay with the Avengers doing whatever they're doing. I don't care. I don't follow that. The whole notion that you have to follow the entire universe of books, I think, is gone now.
Financially, you can't do it. You cannot do it. There's too many books. There used to be a time where I remember I would pick up the Avengers just to kind of keep track in the Fantastic Four.
Sure.
Just to keep track of what was going on in the rest of the Marvel universe. But now all of a sudden, which Avengers book do I follow? Because there's five of them.
And doesn't it seem silly to – I mean, it's that double-edged sort of continuity, right? And in canon, you know, the idea that we want a larger story that ties the universe together, then we can feel like it's all part of a larger thing. But at the same time, and you just mentioned financially, is it feasible to expect someone to be able to keep up with all of that?
Yeah.
And so does it really make a lot of sense to have this continuity that you have to be so dialed into so many books to really understand? No, it doesn't, because people are just not going to be able to keep up with that. And then when you put on top of that the double shipping of books, which we're also seeing pretty frequently with the big two, you're in a situation, a case in point, like I started drowning under some of the titles under the new DC Rebirth stuff that I was, and I'm behind months in some of those books. Now, there are a handful of them that I'm still collecting because I liked what I had read up to that point, but I just can't keep up with them anymore.
Yeah, it's getting bad.
And so if back to basics is going to mean that there is more of a focus on shorter story arcs and people will be able to jump in and jump out and that kind of stuff, then I'm cool with that. But if it's just kind of regurgitating the early stories of these characters, then I could kind of leave that.
Yeah. And I think when I was a young kid and I was reading Captain America or the Hulk, and every time, like there would be every once in a while – they would jump in. Like the Hulk seemed to be in Captain America quite a bit, but it would be like one issue. And to me, it was like, you know what? That was showing me that the universe was together. I didn't need all of this stuff. Like Falcon flying in an alley and seeing like webbing laying there and hanging all over the place. You know what? That was enough for me to say, yep, same universe.
Someone else was here. Yes,
Spidey's web was there. That's all I needed. I didn't need this thing. Having Spider-Man and Johnny Storm be good friends. That was enough. That was enough to show how everything was together. And it I think because the movies did it, like they want to make that one universe.
Sure.
Make one universe, I understand, but don't make it where you're expecting everybody to read everything.
No, and again, it would be easier to do that if they had one book called Marvel Universe and it came out once a month and it was $10.
Yep.
And it had 150 pages in it on newsprint and you could follow everything that's going on in the Marvel Universe, but it's not. It's $5 first issues and $4 you know, subsequent issues, and you just can't keep up with it all.
Nope.
But I want the comic industry to be healthy.
It has to be.
These companies to engage with the fans. I want the fans to be happy with the books that are coming out from them. So you hope that it works, but it just feels like another, you know, sort of thing. So anyways, moving on from that, interesting and somewhat sad news, I think, for people that are used to seeing this staple of San Diego Comic-Con. Mile High Comics is not going to San Diego this year.
That is a problem.
And it's the first time in 44 years they're not going. Let me read you what Chuck had to say on the Mile High Comics website. To answer the numerous questions that we have been receiving of late, for the first time in 44 years, we will not be exhibiting at this year's San Diego Comic-Con. I wish that this decision could have been otherwise, but circumstances beyond our control made our further participation impossible. To explain, San Diego has grown far beyond its original premise, morphing from what was originally a wonderful annual gathering of the comics world into a world-renowned pop culture and media festival. As such, it has seen rapidly escalating costs and also a dramatic change in the demographics of its attendees. Neither of those changes worked to our advantage. To explain a bit more, my First little one-table booth in 1973, which was a year before I was born, cost $40 to rent for the weekend. When we received our booth renewal for last year, our cost of our 70-foot space had been raised to over $18,000. For a weekend, Matthew. That's a car and a half.
I have a problem with that.
Yeah.
Huge problem.
While quite costly, that one factor alone would not have precluded us from returning, as we had paid $16,500 in the rent the previous year. What made this situation nearly impossible, however, was the foot traffic in the exhibit hall declined dramatically last year. Even at its peak on Saturday afternoon, our end of the building, which was primarily comics, was uncrowded. The San Diego fire marshals were partially to blame, as they put much stricter controls on the number of badge holders allowed in the building at any given time. That might not have been such a bad idea, except that it amplified the harm already being caused by the incredible proliferation of off-site events that we are now being set up for upwards of 8 blocks around the convention center. And let's put a pin in that for when we talk about New York Comic Con.
Yes.
When you can see Game of Thrones, Pokemon, and hundreds of other exhibits across the convention hall for free, why bother going into the hall? Across from the convention hall, he said. Many fans did not. To summarize, we experienced rising costs while at the same time foot traffic in our booth plummeted. That is never a good combination. That having been said, I truly loved the experience of exhibiting at San Diego Comic-Con, so I can assure you that I would have ignored those two major obstacles and still renewed my booth. The final straw, however, was the utter indifference of the San Diego Comic-Con management to the fiasco that we endured at the beginning of last year's show when the freight handlers that they had hired failed to deliver our comics to our booth. So how could this awful thing happen? It beats the heck out of me. Our trucker was in line at the convention marshaling yard at 6:30 a.m. on Tuesday morning. At 9 p.m. that evening, with almost all of the other vendors around us unpacked and completely set up, we still did not have our 40,000 pounds of freight. I had 12 workers scheduled to help us set up that day, including Will Lynn Norrie, who flew in from Denver that morning, but all we could do was sit around all day in our totally empty booth. Making matters much worse, at no time during this ordeal or during the show did anyone from the convention management stop by with an apology, an explanation, or even just to commiserate. After 44 years of my supporting them, through good times and bad, this was just too much indifference to endure. When you are in a relationship out of love and passion, but the other party could care less whether you live or die, you have to realize that it's time to move on. I will very much miss San Diego, but I doubt if the convention management will even notice that I am gone. Such is life. Happy collecting. Chuck Rosansky. He also mentioned they have a 30% off sale going on right now at Mile High Comics. The code word for that sale is vacation. This discount code word applied to all 10 million of the back issue comics and magazines, excluding only new issues, a few variants, and slapped comics. So go support the site and, basically support Chuck and Mile High Comics, because they are a legend in the industry, not just at San Diego Comic Con. But I think that speaks to what we talk about all the time on the show, right? When it comes to conventions.
The thing with that, the most upsetting part of this is that when I met Chuck probably 10, 12 years ago at a Big Apple show, I was in awe of this guy because he represented the world of comics, where to me, growing up in Connecticut and reading, that's all my comic book world was. Maybe Connecticut and Massachusetts.
Yep.
That was it. He was out in Colorado and had Mile High Comics in Denver, and he had 4 stores, and he had ads in every single comic. And when I started buying from there, probably in 1979, I remember feeling like I was part of something bigger.
Sure.
And to me, Chuck is one of the most important people in the industry, and I'm not just saying that because we're talking about the story. If he was there at the beginning, that should be – you should get legacy pricing or no pricing. You know what, Chuck?
I wholeheartedly agree with
Chuck,
you.
Chuck, we'll eat the $2,000 or what,
$18,000.
Oh my gosh.
Give us a grand.
You need to do whatever you can to make him go there.
Right.
And the thing that I will always remember about Mile High was I always joke around that I say that Mile High created the internet. Because they were doing things that the internet is doing now. Back then, you would order your catalog. You would spend $10 on a very good copy of a comic.
Right.
Like Captain America 100. And you would, say, would you accept a lower, lesser? I used to go for the lesser. If they didn't have the lesser one, they would give me the next grade at the same price.
Yep.
I never had problems. They were, I would get a package from them, open it up, and I'd probably order like once a year, and it would be like a $50 order, so I would get a ton of stuff. Those were magical times, and to think that he is not given the key to the city in every freaking comic book show really just bothers me to the point of – it just – that is like you've been saying – this is what our industry is right now.
Yeah.
Terrible.
It's very, very unfortunate that you have because to me, like, he should be a guest.
Absolutely. You know, like, he's a celebrity. I mean, Chuck is
– right.
Chuck is like, you know, Mile High Comic. Oh, my God. That's Chuck.
Right.
You know, you see the sign, you get excited. You see Chuck, you even get more excited.
And I realize that it might be difficult for them to give that much amount of space away for free. But half price then. Mm-hmm. I mean, like you said, you should be – the number of years that you've attended that show should factor into that discussion.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, the fact that people – that the foot traffic is down so badly in there is a real bad sign for comics.
Yeah.
You know, and you could say the same thing about what we've seen at sometimes with Artist Alley over at New York Comic Con. And again, I think as Chuck points out, the proliferation of the off-site events – the fact that there are more and more places off-site where people will go for chunks of the day and spend multiple hours when they're not in Artist Alley and they're not at some of these booths is taking more foot traffic out of the building and hurting the traditional core of what those Comic-Cons were about. And again, as he said, they probably won't even notice he's gone.
Yeah.
Because there will be somebody else that comes in and pays for that booth space. And it might cater more toward the audience that is coming to those shows nowadays. But it is unfortunate when you see sort of a legend that's been around for 44 years at the show kind of end up having to not show up again.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah, but so we wish them the best. And who knows? Maybe San Diego, someone reads that post.
Let's hope so.
Reaches out and something can happen.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that. I'd like that to end on a positive note.
I do too.
Well, we're going to end our news on a positive note, Matthew, because there is a brand new Kickstarter that I want to let people know about. Our friends at Onyx Path are going to be launching. Actually, they have launched, as you listen to this, and it's been up for about a week now. The Chronicles of Darkness Dark Eras 2 Kickstarter is already underway. Chronicles of Darkness Dark Eras 2 starts out presenting a chapter for six historical eras, each of which features two Chronicles of Darkness game lines. So if you're familiar with the Chronicles of Darkness role-playing game, vampire, mage, hunter, changeling, all that kind of stuff, each of these eras is going to feature two Chronicles of Darkness game lines, which include Vampire the Requiem, Mage the Awakening, Hunter the Vigil, Changeling the Lost, and more. The rules in this book are compatible with the second edition of the Chronicles of Darkness game. Each terrifying time period is and location is examined through the supernatural creatures that dwell in there. So the eras that they're going to look at is the French Revolution, which will tie into Vampire the Requiem and Demon the Descent. The Great War on the Western Front will involve Geist the Sin Eaters and Werewolf the Forsaken. Light of the Sun, which is Europe in the 1600s, is going to look at Deviant the Renegades and Mage the Awakening. Seven Wonders of the Ancient World, which is 100 to 50 BCE, is going to be Changeling the Lost and Promethean the Created. Rise of the Imperials is going to be China from 1644 to 1911, which will tie into Mummy, the Curse, and Hunter, the Vigil. And 1001 Nights, the Islamic Golden Age from 750 BCE to present, will tie into Beast the Primordial and Vampire the Requiem. So very cool that the supplement is going to tie into multiple game lines, multiple eras, will feature creatures from each era. And for fans of the Chronicles of Darkness game, like, this is a book that kind of appeals to everyone. And again, Onyx Path has such a great history of having Kickstarters and projects that not only get funded and get a ton of support, but the product that comes out the other end is absolutely stunning and amazing. So go check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes. And I'm sure it will be well on its way to being funded. But the cool thing about that is you then start getting into stretch goals.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite part, because a lot of these, especially now, and if you heard our interview last week about the Fox in the Forest game, and we talked a lot about the Kickstarter stuff. With Kickstarter, these companies like Onyx Path that have done multiple Kickstarters now, they have it down to a place where they know exactly what to offer in their core offering. They know exactly what to offer in those stretch goals. And so they are continuing to deliver a better and better project. And get people to want to sign on for more and more. I just backed one from the King and Yellow. It's a King and Yellow role-playing game. And the cool thing is Robin Laws is the one that's putting it on. They are smashing through these stretch goals because each time they're adding another chapter, another book, another supplement, another rule set, another this, that, and the other thing. And to me, that makes it exciting the entire month long that they're going through the Kickstarter process. So again, Onyx Path, Chronicles of Darkness, Dark Eras 2. Go check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes. And stay tuned for an interview with Monica Valentinelli, who is the lead designer on that project.
Very good.
So there you go. That's our news, Matthew. And before we get into comics, we have to talk about facial hair.
We do.
Because even though it's summertime and a lot of people are shaving off their beards and shaving off their mustaches, not these two guys.
No.
These two guys are knee deep in facial hair right now, Matthew.
I am lathered up.
And that's
beard
why,
balm from Viking Oil
And that's why we're using Viking Oil. So VikingOilsLLC.com is where you can go to get the wonderful beard products that keep our facial hair beautiful all year round, Matthew. And of course, especially in the summertime, I find even more so sometimes than the winter, it's really important for me to use the beard oil. And my beard is not going anywhere anytime soon, much to the chagrin of my immediate family. But thanks to Viking Oils, I am pushing right through any resistance that I have from them and continuing to grow this bad boy.
And if you see Gary, he's in witness protection right now from your family.
Yes. Yeah, Gary's not welcome at our house, but only because it's his fault that I still have this beard.
But thank you so much, Gary, because your products are awesome.
All right, Matthew, let's get into some comics. And I am going to kick us off today with comics. And I am going to talk about, if I can pull it up on my tablet here, the latest issue of Giant Days from Boom. Now, for any of you that have been listening to the show for any length of time, then you know that arguably my favorite comic book that is going right now is Giant Days from Boom. It's under the Boombox imprint. Giant Days is created and written by John Allison, pencils by Max Sarin, inks by Liz Fleming, colors by Whitney Kogar, letters by Jim Campbell, and the editors are Shannon Waters and Jasmine Amiri. Giant Days is the absolutely fantastic comic that just brings me back to my comic days because my college days, because it is about Esther and Daisy and Susan, three friends that met at college and ended up at first dorming together and now living together in an apartment, and the sort of day-to-day slice of life stuff that goes on with them with a little touch of the ridiculous. And so as we open up this issue here, it actually takes us back to when they signed their lease for this new apartment when they first moved off campus. And the landlord is there, and the landlord's saying, so I'll have it all painted for you in September. What do you think? And they sort of huddle up and they come back and say, we'll take it. And he's like, that's super. You know, I'll get the contracts. And all of a sudden you have Daisy say, well, what about this garage? This is our house number, right? We get to use this garage. And the guy's like, no, I'm afraid that's off limits. So, you know, just don't even think about the garage. And the big font at the bottom says, and so they didn't. And now we fast forward a year to right now. And as you have Ed, which is one of their friends, and Esther playing Scrabble at the apartment, all of a sudden they're hearing noises upstairs, things getting smashed around, and it's because Daisy and her girlfriend are fighting. And one of the big plot lines that's gone through this issue is that Daisy is dealing with her first long-term relationship, and she met a girl at school, and she is sort of figuring things out for herself, but also trying to navigate her first relationship, and it is getting volatile at times. And so as she's going through that, the rest of the roommates are sort of trying to figure out when to give advice or when to kind of hang back and just let her kind of experience that stuff for herself. But clearly at this point in time, she's really kind of struggling. And what's happening is when her and her girlfriend are fighting, hours after the argument is over, and Matthew, you and I know this trait well, she's still thinking about it in her head.
Oh, yeah.
She's still having the conversation in her head hours after the argument is over, and her girlfriend has completely already let it go. And she is up in the middle of the night. She can't sleep. And so she decides she's going to get up and she's going to go downstairs and do something productive. I'm going to bake some bread. She goes into the kitchen and all of a sudden she hears something outside and she looks out and it seems like somebody is kind of skulking around the garage that they're not supposed to think about, the garage that they haven't thought about in the past year. And so what this whole issue ends up surrounding is them trying to figure out what's going on in the garage. It's locked. They don't want to break into it. They call their friend McGraw, who Susan, one of their other roommates, had dated for a while and is now secretly dating again. But he is like this sort of jack of all trades who is very nerdy about building things and engineering and all that kind of stuff. But he has like his own strict code of honor. So they're trying to convince him to lockpick the padlock that's on this thing, and he would never do that because it would break the locksmith code and stuff like that. And so the whole episode comes down to they're trying to figure out what's going on in here. And when they finally get into the garage, they find out that it is a place where animals are being stored, because I want to say like the landlord must own a pet store or something like that. But they open up the garage and there's an old man in there and he's got a bunch of chinchillas. And he's got like crates and crates of chinchillas, and they're all being well taken care of, but this is like where they live. And they're like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. And so they end up running into the landlord and saying, you know what? We're not going to call animal control on you guys. We're not going to get you in trouble as long as you let us play with the chinchillas for the rest of the night. And of course he does. And then everybody's happy. But the whole issue around like them trying to guess what's going on in there, is it full of spiders? Is there somebody living in there? Is there all this kind of stuff interspersed with poor Daisy, who's going through this tumultuous time with her girlfriend, is just kind of like the perfect example of the mundane and sort of everyday slice of life stuff that we all go through, especially during our college years. And then the just completely ridiculous, you know, that there's a chinchilla farm basically in their garage. And that's one of the things that I love the most about these characters and these stories, is that they are constantly kind of putting those two things together. There's always a storyline of something ridiculous happening, and then there is the day-to-day stuff that, to me, makes me very nostalgic for when I first lived in college. And I know I've talked about this before, but I lived in a dorm for the first year and a semester, and then I moved off campus with a bunch of people that I had met at college. And then, you know, I met my wife at college, and we lived together for a time, but I lived with other people too, and that kind of stuff. And that sort of navigating relationships and making friendships with people that you never would have otherwise met, and you know, going through tough times with those people as well, is what I think this book does so well. And then they have a layer of insanity on the top of it with some of the adventures that the characters get into, that even if you never stayed at college, and even if you never went away, and even if you never did that, you'll still find stuff that pulls you into this book. And I feel like it's just superbly written. The artwork, the character design is just absolutely wonderful, and it has a charm to it that no other book that I currently read has. And every month when it comes out, it is the first thing that I want to read the day that it comes out. And so I cannot recommend Giant Days enough. If you have not checked it out yet, I think the latest trade just came out. You can go on Amazon, you can get them. You can get them all on Comixology as well, or you can go to Boom's website. But Giant Days is absolutely amazing. This is a book that I buy for friends when they are not super into comics, but I want to recommend an amazing book to them. I've sent this first trade out to like five different people, because that's how much I love this book.
Very good. So a book that has a lot in my life, like you were talking about the sort of, you read that and you can see how there's so many parallels between you. You obviously didn't have a chinchilla farm in your garage.
I didn't, but I do think chinchillas are adorable. And if a next door neighbor had a garage full of chinchillas, I would also want to play with them all night.
Yes. So I'm going to take a book that I've been reading for an awful long time from a show I've been watching since the beginning, and that is The Simpsons. It's on issue 239 from Bongo Comics. Ian Boothbay is the writer, Phil Ortiz the penciler, Andrew Pipoy is the inker, and Nathan Kane is the editor on this one, and Karen Bates does the lettering. This one's called Brouhaha. Now, before we get into the story, I do have to talk about a few of the really interesting things going on at Bongo Comics. So there's a picture at the front that has Disco Stew, and Bart is kind of highlighting his platform shoes. And it says, Simpsons comic fans, you asked for more platforms. And Bart says, and here they are, man. And at the bottom it says, nope, we're talking about digital platforms. So if you go to the official Bongo website on the Simpsons store, and it's bongocomics.com, every month there is a new solo adventure by somebody. You've got Krusty the Clown has one, but the big one coming out this month, I think, is June, if I can find the ad really quick, is Mo Sizlak, the Mighty Mo Sizlak. That's going to be available in June. And I believe there are a couple bucks in their full comics. So I think that is a really cool way to do that, to get you some of these other stories. So we start out with Lisa telling a story about Amelia Spaceheart, who is the person, she's the young girl that goes out and collects all the junk in outer space and recycles it. And in this bin of recycled stuff, you've got Tweaky, you've got the Nomad droid from Star Trek that they patterned the V'ger episode from the first movie after. You've got a Sputnik, and you've got the radioactive bar that Homer, you always see at the beginning of the episode.
Right.
And as Lisa's typing this up, you see that she's sitting in a coffee bar called Brouhaha, and it's a place called, it's Krusty Coffee Bar. So she's sitting there, and she's like, oh, you know, the guy comes over to give her the bill, and it's the guy who talks like this, who they call him Pimply Teen. You know, she goes, well, I already paid for the tea. And he goes, well, this is for the Wi-Fi. And she looks over and she's like, what? And he goes, yeah, the free website, the free Wi-Fi here isn't actually free. So she has this huge bill and she's like, I'm not going to be able to pay that. So then she goes to court and Krusty's there and saying, you know, this is the best way to do this. And, you know, we got to make this girl pay. We've got to do this. And, you know, she's got to pay the whole thing. And I don't care if she can't pay it. So then afterwards, the lawyer comes out, the lawyer that we always see in the episodes, whose name is Mr. Lawyer Man. And she's saying, you know, Lisa's like, I can't pay this and I don't know what to do. And he goes, well, I've got something that we can do. You've heard of pop-up stores. Well, how about if you have a Brouhaha pop-up store in your house? So they're going to turn the Simpsons house into a Brouhaha store. And it's right in the living room. Marge is there. Homer comes down in his underwear and the house is full of people. And the great thing about this is when you have the comic, and since Phil Hartman passed away, we don't have a lot of the characters like Lionel Hutz and the characters that he did. But you get to see all these characters in the comic still. And Marge is like, look, you know, this has been a coffee house. I've been working all day. You need to get in here. So as he puts the apron on and starts to, you know, get coffee, Lisa's there. Maggie's there making the coffee. And then one of her teachers, Mrs. Hoover, comes in. And Lisa's like, oh, you know what? Maybe I can get some extra credit if I do a really nice job putting the foam, like styling the foam in her coffee. So she says that it's a replica of our state. And since Simpsons has never been told what state it is, she's blocking it with her hand so you can't see the state.
Didn't they decide that, though?
Well, they had the contest, and I believe it's Vermont.
I thought so, yeah.
But living in Springfield, Mass., it's still Springfield, Mass.
It will always be Springfield, Massachusetts, yep. So there's no doubt about that.
When you have a mayor with a Boston accent.
They just told Vermont that to make them feel better.
Yeah, because they felt bad.
Yep.
So she drinks the coffee. She heads out there. And then for the next three or four parts of this, it is Lisa just trying to impress people with her foam-making ability. She molds a city hall for Mayor Quimby. And this beautiful woman walks by and he smushes it down and chases her. But the other side story going on in this, oh, but the other funny one, since this is in their home, everybody is going through assuming like everything in the house is for sale. So some guy is talking to Bart going, are these vintage records for sale? And he's like, yeah, you can have them for $10, $10 each. No, all for $10. One of them is an ultra-rare recording of the Chipmunks as the Beatles performing the Monkees' greatest hits called Last Yellow Submarine to Clarksville. And so he takes that. But the other story going on here is that you have Comic Book Man, you've got Marge's sisters, and you've got Lenny who are trying to make a comic book in the store. And they're all working on their computers. Lenny's got his tablet. And then, or they're making a movie script, and Bart comes in and says, yeah, you know what? It's going to cost too money. Why don't you just make a comic book? It's easier. And Lenny gets so frustrated at the waste of time, he rips the paper in half like you would if you were using paper, but it was his tablet.
Mm.
So he rips the tablet. And then he's like, oh, man, what am I going to do? So the rest of it is them trying to put together the story. So the four of them are working on this script. And they finally get this script all ready, and they get an artist. This guy comes in. They talk about him. He's like, I just came for an espresso. They won't let me leave. And this guy said that he's a comic book artist that volunteered to draw. And in the thing, you have it starting out. And you, since whoever is writing it, like you have Comic Book Man, so obviously it's going to start at the comic book store at the Android Dungeon. Then you have Lenny who's writing it, so the main character is going to be Carl. And you've got Carl in there. Getting up, he's on the phone and he sees that a dinosaur is attacking the city. Instead of the Daily Planet, it's the Daily Donut. And then Carl, turns into Carl Blue and Carl Red, much like Superman.
Nice.
And instead of – and then like each of the logos, one of them is a C for Carl and the other one's a K for Carl. And I love Carl. Carl is one of my favorite characters.
Yep.
And he goes in there. He saves the day. He saves a woman from the dinosaur attack. And then Bart reads the book and he's like, ugh. She goes, and they're like, what do you think? And then all of a sudden this robot comes flying through the window and says, everybody must leave this shop immediately. And you see that it's a robot. It's speaking in proper English. And you find out that it is a robot from Professor Frink, who has a drop-in tea shop in his house. And this is now hurting his business. So he sent the robot over there to go and talk. They go over to Frink's. They stop him. The place is called the Tea Square, which I think is a great name.
Uh-huh.
They go in there. They shut him down. And then there's just a battle that goes on. And since it's a tea place, they take it on like it's the Boston Tea Party. So that's all the craziness going on. Then they decide that they're not going to be able to do the comic book because the comic book is so horrible. And then the lawyer comes in and says that you've paid your dues and you are all set. And then that is how the episode or the issue ends. The Bongo Beat by Nathan Kane, he's the editor, always does a great job with these. These are very much like it's set up. I'll show you, Brian, like the old Marvel ones.
Yep.
Where it's almost like Stan
Soapbox. Like the bullpen bulletin.
He gives you all the things that are going on. You also have a bonus value stamp, clip and collect. Then it also says don't clip because you're going to ruin the value of your comic. And a letters page that is just full of a lot of young fans sending their art and having a lot of fun. So when The Simpsons are on hiatus, I really look forward to this comic book more and more. Love it, love it. I don't think – it's funny because The Simpsons have been on over 20 years now.
Yep.
I've been reading the comic book for probably 15. I still don't see myself ever getting sick of it.
I would say in the last 10 years, I've probably read more Simpsons comics than watched Simpsons episodes.
Yes.
Because I don't watch it every week.
Oh, see, we've DVR'd and glued on Sunday.
Uh-huh. All right, Matthew. Well, let's jump over to Marvel for our final new book of the week. And actually, this one is a couple weeks old. But we're going to talk about Cable, number one. The last Cable series that I collected was the one where Ariel Olivetti was – it was the one where he had Hope.
The baby.
He was taking her through time and stuff like that. But with all the new relaunch of the X-Men books, I figured I would give Cable a shot. And as we open up this particular issue, and by the way, the creative team on this one, James Robinson is the writer. Carlos Pacheco is the penciler. Rafael Fontariz is the inker. Jesus Abertov is the colorist. And Corey Pettit does the letters. The editor on this book is Mark Paniccia. So as we start off, we are beginning in 1874 in Nobleen, Arizona, in the United States. And of course, we're in a town with a saloon. And you see inside the saloon, you have a bunch of outlaws who are sitting around a table playing poker. And one of them saying, so when do you reckon we're going to move on from here? And the other guy's saying, why would we move on from here? It's going great. We got plenty of business to do around here. And look at the locals. They're too scared to squawk. And the camera sort of pans over. And you see that that's because there's a couple of them that are dead on the ground. And the other ones are kind of watching in horror. And as they're playing this poker game, they're talking about, you know, who's going to be here that's going to stop us? And as they say that, you see a metal arm kind of push the doors of the saloon open. And one of the guys says, oh, I reckon this is the fellow we were told about. And you flip the page, and of course, it's Cable. And Cable says, good. Then there's no need for introductions. And of course, he comes in and basically tells these guys that they're screwed. And they don't believe him. And so they get into a knockdown, drag-out fight. But what's different about this fight, Matthew, is that after he throws one through the window and he turns on the rest of them, they pull out guns that seem really far advanced for 1874. And they says, oh, you weren't expecting this, were you? You might have gotten yourself a big gun, but so do we. And he's like, I've seen bigger. And he kicks the crap out of these guys. And only one of them is left standing when he's done. And he's got this guy strung up from a chandelier. And he's interrogating him. And the guy's telling him, I can't tell you anything. Or, you know, the guy's going to come back and then, you know, we're dead. And he says, well, whoever threatened you isn't here now. I'm here. Tell me what's going on. And he proceeds to say that they had just robbed a stage. They were up in the hills hiding when all of a sudden there's a big flash of light and somebody shows up and promises to trade them weapons for helping him look for something. And so Cable says, why don't you take me out and show me where he was looking? So he takes him out into the desert and he takes him out to a place where The outlaw is saying that the guy supposedly found what he was looking for and then disappeared. And he looks out over this canyon, and there's a huge crop circle, like, carved into the stone, all these symbols. And so Cable jumps out of that time. Next thing you know, he is in 1543 in Japan, in the Hida province. And there is another huge crop circle, this time actually out in the grasslands. And he is following it, and he follows its trail to a village that is completely on fire. And there seems to be only one woman and her child that are left alive. And he says, "Who did this?" And she said, men with swords of fire. They came through, they destroyed the whole village, and they killed my family. And he says, "Well, I'm going to avenge them." And he keeps following the trail up into the hills. And you see that up in the hills nearby, there are a group of three Ronin. And they're talking about how, man, it was really easy to take down that village, and I'm sure the next one we go to is going to be even easier. Who's out here to stop us? And as they're talking, one of the guys is saying, "Do you really think we need to wait for this guy who's supposed to be chasing us, that the guy who hired us said is coming?" And as soon as he says that, you hear a snap over in the bushes, and Cable shows up. Except these three guys are not alone. These three guys who are wielding swords that are very technologically advanced have a whole bunch of guys that have been waiting for Cable to show up as well, and they all end up attacking him, like a dozen of them. So he ends up fighting all of these guys with these almost like digital swords, and one of them ends up chopping off his metal arm, and they end up subduing him. And as the issue winds down, Cable is knocked out unconscious on the ground, and these guys are all sort of waiting to finish him off. And so you never find out through the issue who he's chasing or what specifically this person was looking for in these different eras, but you kind of don't need to know that because that's part of the mystery. And so if you have never read a Cable book, if you didn't follow whatever the last series he was in, I don't think you need to, because it really jumps in with him hopping through different time periods on the trail of someone who is leaving gangs behind for him to fight. And it's easy to jump into. And despite some of the number one issues that launch at $5, this one's only $4. And only being a term that I use in quotations.
Save a buck.
But if you're interested in the new Cable, I would definitely say the first issue is interesting, and I will be checking out the second one. So it's definitely worth picking up if you are a fan of that character. So that is it for our new books this week. But we have our summer reading project to get into, Matthew. And the last time we left off, we were about to jump into, of course, the Judge Dredd Complete Case Files Volume 1. But we were about to get into almost like a Planet of the Apes style story here.
Yeah, and I started noticing I was dragging ahead a little bit looking at one of the other stories getting ready to start.
Yep.
Because what is really interesting about the stories that we're going to talk about is we're going to have this story right here. About the monkey,
the ape gang,
sort of like the ape gang. Yeah,
Don Uggy and the ape gang,
the old 20s gangsta apes.
Yeah, like the Al Capone style.
We're going to have a 2-part story, and then we're going to jump into this epic tale.
Right. Yes.
So it's really, really interesting how you see that this is sort of the evolution of how popular this character became, and how, like, this ape story right here, as we read this. This could have easily been 3 or 4 issues. You could have had a ton of fun with this one. So they threw this one together. But you've got Judge Dredd, who found out that there is a gang of apes. Don Uggy is going out there, and he's doing all sorts of bad stuff, robbing things, robbing people, causing all sorts of calamity. And you see, like, what he does. There's a couple panels where, you know, give him the works, boys.
Yeah.
And you see him roughing up some humans.
Well, and the gang leader shows up and says, "Look, there's a gang on the east side of town that has been going and causing trouble for our businesses and taking out some of our guys. If you don't do something about it, Judge Dredd,
we will.
You're gonna have a gang war on your hands."
Yeah.
And Dredd basically says, "Look, you're just as much of a scumbag as these other guys over here. Get lost, the both of you, or I'm going to take you all down." And then they give, as you said, this could have been an issue in and of itself. They basically go on to explain that, you know, they, at one point in time, they became technologically advanced enough to give apes the ability to think like humans. And so some of them have been altered. Their brain cells were altered to give them the ability to speak.
Yep.
And as the apes went through, like, a second evolution, they then took on the personalities of human beings, and they couldn't control which human beings from what time period that they took on the personalities of. So, of course, some of them decided to be gangsters.
Yeah.
And that's basically what they have now. And so now Dredd has to deal with this gang war that's going on across the city now because he didn't jump in earlier.
Like, they are taking over. There's a Grunt Brothers garage that they had a problem with, so they're going to knock that down. You see somebody that screwed him over business-wise, so he's got cement on his feet, and they're throwing him in the river.
Right. You get, like, the montage of the two gangs taking out members of each other's gangs.
So as this is going on, you've got Judge Dredd, who is trying to figure out a way to stop this, and he's like, you know what? I'm going to go talk to Dan Uggie's mom. And to do this, he's got to climb a tree because she lives up in a tree, which is hysterical. You see him up there climbing, and she gets up there, and he's like, you know, you need to tell me what's going on. Your son's a vicious hoodlum. And she's like, my Uggie, he's a good ape, and he's not hurting anybody, and blah, blah, blah. So he finds out what he is doing, and he stops him before he gets over. And the thing is like, they're driving around in cars. They've got the old Tommy guns. As they pull him over, the apes are not going to go quietly, and they pull out the Tommy guns. There is a big shootout with all the judges, and they're throwing in the things about, you know, no more monkey business for you, Fast Eek, and they're just screaming at each other and doing all that stuff. And once they finally catch the gang and get them, they don't throw them in jail per se. They put him behind bars, though.
Well, and it's on a technicality because basically once – so the judges end up taking out both gangs, and then you have Don Uggie who's basically saying like, hey, man, human laws don't apply to me.
Yep.
And he says, well, you know, actually we have the Animal Nuisance Act of 1987, which basically says that if animals are causing a threat to human life, then they can be placed in captivity.
Yeah.
And so he ends up sentencing them to the local zoo.
And that's where they are, and – you see them all being made fun of because you've got the humans looking out going, look at that one. That one's dressed like a stupid old gangster.
Right.
And he's in there like, you know, what a revolt and development. This is what's going to happen. So now, sports fans, we turn to the annual Mega City 5000 race. Now, this is a race not sanctioned by anybody in the city.
It's basically from the movie Death Race.
Yes. Yeah. This is bad guys going from one part of town of Mega City to the other. And if somebody like an old man gets in their way,
sure,
they're just going to get run over.
Right. It doesn't specifically say that they get points for killing civilians, but they certainly have no problem in killing civilians as they're trying to establish dominancy through this particular race.
Yeah. And like, so, like you said, it's exactly like Death Race. You see where I believe Death Race was a British movie.
Which is actually – there's two now – this is one of two stories over the next couple episodes that are sort of inspired by Death Race.
Yes, there are.
Yeah.
So we have this old gentleman who's walking across the street, and he's got his cane, and then you hear, out of my way, old man, and then you see the cane being snapped in half by the motorcycle tire.
Right.
So it did not work out well for them. So now the judges are on to this one. They've got to stop this race before people get hurt, people get killed. The people that are racing it are bad dudes. They're gang members.
And I think the guy's name, I think his name is Spikes.
Yeah.
But there's one guy that looks like the, from Flash Gordon.
Well, that's, I was going to get to that, Brian Blessed. Yeah. Abso-freaking-lutely.
Yeah, totally, right?
So when we, as they're racing through, the judges set up roadblocks and the gang leader, he has got the Spike, I believe, he's the one.
Yep.
Because he's got the old German army helmet with a spike on top. As they're going through, the judges are getting ready to stop them, and there is a big battle going on, and he, the Spike guy, and a couple of his other guys break the roadblock, and now they've gotten free, and they're kind of on the run. Now, when you turn the page on this one, he's talking about any creep who gets in my way is going to end up with a perforated face. And then you turn the page, and the thing that is the coolest part for me, Brian Belonzart, this is where the guy who is most known for drawing Judge Dredd really comes in. I think he did one before.
He takes over for part two of this story.
Yeah.
So in the first part of the story, it's a different artist because it is in part one, it is Bill Ward.
Yep.
And then in part two, Brian Bolland jumps in.
And there is miles apart. Brian Bolland is probably one of the greatest comic artists that ever lived. He is the artist on The Killing Joke from Batman. So as this is going on, they're running through there, and now the judges are getting a little upset. And what I love about this one, it has now almost become Judge Dredd versus the Spike guy.
Well, it's like a three-way race now.
Yeah.
You got the judges getting involved, too.
So the judge is there, and like you said, he looks like the Hawkman from Flash Gordon. He's got the Brian Blessed look. And I will tell you this, that when I was reading everything that he said, and he's part of the gang, the Muties, when – everything that he said, I heard it in that Brian Blessed, really deep voice, like that.
And we also see the return of Judge Giant.
Yes.
Who the last time
the
we saw him, he was saving a young kid.
Yep.
This time he ends up being the one who goes head to head in a game of chicken with Spikes, the leader of the Muties.
Yep. And the cool part is when they basically play chicken and Giant jumps, Otto jumps off his bike or gets ejected off the bike. And when the two bikes crash, Spike goes flying through. And as he's kind of going through the air and hitting the ground, he's still kind of realizing, I can win this race.
Right. He's like inches away from the finish line. And Judge Dredd's whole thing was, look, we can't let these gangs finish the race, because if they finish the race, there will be a winner. And if there's a winner, then they're going to want to do it again next year. And
yep.
It's going to continue this rivalry. We have to make sure nobody finishes the race. And so the guy ends up dying like a millimeter away
yeah.
from crossing the finish line. But the cool thing about it to me was that Judge Giant was the one who saved the day here.
Yep.
And so in the other story that he was involved in, same thing there. So it's kind of cool that most of the time Judge Dredd is the one who is the hero
yeah.
or the person who resolves the issue at hand. But in both of these stories with Judge Giant, it's been Judge Giant that does that.
Yeah, and that was really cool to see that. And again, the art, fantastic. Very just
right.
Loved it. So the next story, this is where we start to begin this huge arc that is going to take probably, if you were reading this, it probably is about 15 or 20 issues of 2000 AD.
Yep.
Judge Dredd gets a letter. And it's really funny because if you ever think about this, why did it take this long to come up with this idea? Because Star Wars was huge, space
sure.
was huge. So Judge Dredd gets a letter. And it says basically that you are hereby appointed to be the judge marshal of Luna 1, the United States colony on the moon of North America. And what happens is every year a judge from one of the mega cities has to go
right,
there.
There's three cities, and every year one of the judges gets picked to be the judge marshal up there for a period of time.
And they don't want a judge marshal up there.
No, and most of the time they don't last a full year
yes.
because they end up getting killed. But Judge Dredd gets this, and he just takes it in stride.
Yep,
this is what I'm being sent to do. Poor Walter's crying. What are we going to do? I
yeah.
don't want you to go. And he's like, hey, this is what I got to do. Help me pack up my stuff and let me get out of here. And, of course, right off the bat, the antics ensue because Walter
stowaways.
Stowed away.
Yep, and it's really funny because you see the thing where they give you a little origin about the moon. And why it's an American colony, because we got there and we made it the United States moon. That's
right.
basically what happened. So Judge is reading some of his law books and he's like, what's going on in my trunk? And he opens it up and there's Walter. Oh, please, I couldn't stand to be without you. But before anything can even get settled on this one, all of a sudden you've got a missile being shot at the shuttle that's bringing them to
right,
the moon.
They haven't even landed yet.
And the guy flying it, you know, Judge Dredd's like, what is this? Who's this from? And he's like, oh, don't worry about it. Just some kids.
Well, and the best part is the guy who's piloting the ship or captaining the ship is like, well, I guess we're dead.
He doesn't. Yeah. Judge Dredd's like, do this, do that. And they avoid the missile. But I don't.
They basically drop a bunch of cargo and the missile hits that instead of hitting the ship. And he saves the day. But the captain was pretty much ready to call it a day.
Yeah.
Well, I guess they fired a missile at us. I guess we're done for.
Just some kids. Just
yeah.
some kids.
The laws are so lax
yep.
on the moon that kids are able to get their hands on, you know, basically whatever they want. So
yep.
Judge Dredd is thinking, there's a lot of work for me to do here. I'm going to be keeping busy.
So we're now one page in, or three. So one page into a space flight, he almost gets killed. The next page, he's trying to settle into his apartment and he almost gets killed because somebody does not want him there.
Right. The robot that they've appointed to be his assistant while he's there because they didn't know he was bringing Walter,
yep.
neither did he, tries to kill him with an axe.
Yep. He says, you know, Walter picks him up and he's a little twerpy robot. And Walter picks him up and says, hey, you know what? We don't need you anymore. I serve Judge Dredd. You do not. You need to go. And then all of a sudden, a huge axe comes out of nowhere, a crazy look on his face. And then Fred One goes after Judge Dredd. And he turns around and he chops the law book. And that was not really good for Judge Dredd right there. And he's like, who sent you here? What's going on? And he picks him up and throws him out the window and he blows up. And that is the end of this part. So now you're starting to understand Judge Dredd isn't welcome here. This is not a good place for him to go. And we see that in the next one where it's called Showdown at Luna 1, where you see that this is like the Wild West. You've got this robot that is saying that, you know, whoever the marshal is here, I'm going to kill him. We
right.
don't want the marshal here. And he's riding around. You've got another guy who's sort of like the sheriff in this part riding a mechanical horse. He's a robot horse. they're coming through. Judge Dredd is going by where, you know, the Apollo landing landed, and there's a little, you know, little place set up for it, like a little museum, and people have defiled it, and it says, "Eat at Mooney's." So people have, you know, Judge Dredd's like, "This is awful. I can't believe how much lawlessness is going on around here." And he's, you know, it's interesting because there's a lot of room to move around where mega cities are always crowded and hectic. You've got a lot of empty spaces in the panels.
And what he's finding out, too, is that this name Mooney keeps appearing all over stuff. It seems like this guy Mooney's name is everywhere. And he starts to figure out that this is someone who holds a lot of sway here on the moon.
So as he goes in, he goes into a saloon. You get the saloon fight. You get
he shoots out the gravity boots of somebody, and it sends him flying across the room.
And you just get all these great moments. And this, to me, is where it almost becomes more Jonah Hex-ish, where you realize how much of the same character they are. Walter comes in, and they're talking about this robot, and Walter's going to go out, and he's going to, you know, Judge Dredd, this robot.
It's like a quick draw robot that challenges him to, you know, to a duel. And then you've got Judge Tex, who is like this. It's hard to tell if he's crooked or if he's just cowardly.
I think it's that. I think
because
he's just
like
bum.
Says to Judge Dredd, "Oh, well, you know, this is your fight, so I'm just going to let you take it from here."
Yeah, nobody
he
ever beats this robot. Nobody ever beats this robot. He's never lost. So all of a sudden, Judge Dredd gets him, and as the bullets are hitting him and shooting him and busting him up, the robot's going, "He beat me, but I'll take him with me." And he keeps shooting at him. So then that ends up like where he finally takes him down and blows him up. But you're also seeing everybody else there is kind of saying, "Hey, you know what? They're gunning for you."
Well, and Judge Dredd says to Tex, "You know, you stood there watching like you hoped this robo-slinger would nail me, and you had the opportunity to plant a signal device in my badge because he was shooting bullets that were like homing bullets."
Yeah.
And Tex is like, "Well, you know, maybe I ain't all that hot on new Marshals, Dredd, but I'm not no traitor." And then he says, "You know, your badge was made by Mooney Fabrications, and that robot also was made by, has the Mooney brand on it. Maybe there's a link to that." So Judge Dredd is starting to zero in on the fact that this Mooney guy is someone that he's going to want to find out some more about.
He's like the Wesley from Roadhouse.
Yes.
Yep, that's what I'm looking at. And Judge Dredd is our Patrick Swayze. So you have the next story. It's the Christmas story. And it's the Red Christmas. And you've got this guy here who's dressed as Santa Claus. And he is talking about the fact that this is going to be Judge Dredd's last Christmas.
Right, because Geek Gorgon, a guy that he had previously had run-ins with, is here on the moon and wants to kill Judge Dredd.
Yep, so he is here. And you've got the judge and Walter out walking around. And it's always funny because it says, "I'm Walter, try me." That's his little thing on his belly.
Right.
The little message that's on there. And he's talking about all the great gifts that he's going to get for Judge Dredd and all this stuff. So Judge Dredd's sitting there and he's talking to his people, you know, talking about the, you know, 6 month penal servitude for littering.
Right. He's basically getting bored because he's got to deal with all these disputes and kind of like civil issues because he's the judge marshal.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden a message comes over the video communication system where this guy, Geek Gorgon, has kidnapped Walter.
Yep.
And he says, "I'm going to kill your robot unless you come and meet me at this room, and you're going to meet me alone." And, you know, you have Tex basically saying, "Look, you can get another robot." And Judge Dredd is like, "Well, you know, I've gotten used to the little guy, so I'm going to go figure out what's going on." So he knows he's walking into a trap. He's going to walk into that trap anyways. But before he goes, he says, "You know, this Geek Gorgon guy likes to kill with this axe thing that he has. Send down to the armory for a strip of flexi steel. I reckon I might need a little insurance." Mm. And come to find out, that was very thoughtful on Judge Dredd's part, because when he goes and meets this guy at the apartment room that he said he was going to meet him at, sure enough, you've got Walter that is sort of wired with explosives. You've got this guy waiting to kill Judge Dredd, and Dredd really can't fight his way out of this one, because if he does, then the trigger's going to go off on the bomb that's going to blow up Walter. And so you have Geek Gorgon who tells Judge Dredd, "I want you to put your head down on this table because I'm going to chop it off."
And when he does, he ruins his axe. Merry Christmas to him.
Yeah, just absolutely destroys it. And it turns out that Judge Dredd used that piece of flexi steel to wrap around his neck so that when this guy tried to behead him, he ended up breaking his axe instead. And that's how Judge Dredd defeats him. And then the epilogue to this story is that later on in Judge Dredd's quarters, he has to sit there and open all of the gifts that Walter made for him or bought for him. And Walter's absolutely loving watching that. But at the same time, Walter's having this internal dialogue about like, he didn't get me anything.
Yep.
And I'm going to try not to cry. And Judge Dredd kind of lets him think for a little while that he didn't get him anything. And then he says, you know, wow, look what I found under the Christmas tree. And he hands him a new drink dispenser tap.
So,
Walter is like just beside himself with joy because Judge Dredd thought of him on Christmas and bought him something. And that's how the story ends.
The best part for me in this one, in this story, was when Judge Dredd has the pair of pajamas and they say Judge Dredd on the butt.
Right.
And he's like, why did all the gifts have my name on it?
Right.
And Walter's like, so when I go to the laundromat, everybody can see that I'm your robot. I mean, he freaking loves Judge Dredd.
He is completely infatuated with Judge
he
Dredd.
Loves
absolutely,
him.
100%.
And the spigot, it's like, you know, you're going to be drinking stuff out of this robot now.
Right.
That's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is how that part ends. And that's the end of these, right?
No. And then we have one more called 22nd Century Futsy. And this is actually my favorite one out of the bunch because, as we heard before, the Futsies are basically someone who gets completely overwhelmed with the pace of life and technology in this particular time, and they just snap.
Yep.
And they become like a berserker. And you have this guy who is Arthur Goodworthy, and he works at this place where he's basically a paper pusher, but he's so far behind on his work that he gets called into the office of Mr. Mooney. And Mr. Mooney, you never see him. He wears kind of a hood over his head. You never see his face, and he is never kind of there in person. He's just up on the screen, and he's yelling at this guy. And this guy's saying, Mr. Mooney, I'm sorry. You know, my wife had to go to the hospital for an operation, and that's why I fell behind in my work. And Mr. Mooney says, that's not good enough. You should have thought of all of that stuff before. You have until 12 o'clock tonight to make up the backlog or your contract will be terminated. That is all. So this guy's going to lose his job and maybe more.
Like 3,000 yep. things he's got to
file. If he doesn't get his work done. So he's got to do months and months worth of work in one night. And it also happens to be the night that they're having the New Year's Eve party at the office.
And everybody's dressed in costume. It's
everybody's
like a costume,
in costume.
New Year's Eve party.
They're from different time periods, and they are living it up, drinking it up, having a great time. He's at his desk, like in the middle of this party,
yep.
and he's just like, "Come on, fellas, I got to work. Can you please just let me go?" And you see, he's making his way through the piles, making his way through all this stuff. He finally gets through all of the paperwork. I did it. I've done it. I've saved. I stacked everything up, and all of a sudden, this drunk guy comes wandering over in a pirate outfit
yep.
and says, it's 12 o'clock. Yeah, Happy New Year. And he throws all of the papers up in the air, which causes poor Arthur to have a complete nervous breakdown.
Flips out.
And he becomes a Futsie.
Yep.
He grabs the club that somebody that was dressed like a caveman was carrying around and smashes this dude in the face. And he starts going through the party and basically killing everyone. And so you have one of the women he works with calls the judges and says, you know, somebody better call his family. They're going to want to be the first to know Arthur's turned Futsie. And so Judge Dredd finds out about this because Arthur's kid, his son, shows up at Justice Headquarters and says to Judge Dredd, you know, I'm little Arthur Goodworthy and my daddy, they say he's gone Futsie. Can you help me? Can you help him? And so Judge Dredd says, sure, I'll see what I can do. And he follows him there. And sure enough, by the time they get to the office building, you know, Arthur has put the smackdown on most of the people that are there at the party, but instead of shooting him, Judge Dredd disarms him and incapacitates mm-hmm. him. And the kid is like, you know, you could have shot him, but you didn't. You're the best judge there is, Judge Dredd. And Judge Dredd says, you know, he's mentally ill. And so he's going to, instead of going to jail, he's going to go and get treatment. But while he's talking, a couple of the henchmen for Mr. Mooney show up because when he was going to terminate him, he was literally going to terminate him. And so they show up to kill him. And you have Judge Dredd end up taking these guys out and saying to himself, you know what? I need to figure out who this Mr. Mooney is because all I keep seeing is this guy's name and I'm going to put a stop to this once and for all. And that's where this particular group of stories that we're going to talk about today ends. And so for the next homework assignment, you want to read the next one, which is called Meet Mr. Mooney. And you want to go through from that story all the way through the story that is called The Oxygen Desert. And mm-hmm. that is a two-parter. So that's your next assignment, is to go for Meet Mr. Mooney through The Oxygen Desert. And that is going to be our next assignment for our summer reading project. So with that, now it is time to get into our creator spotlight. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, Monica Valentinelli, author, writer, game developer. She is the lead developer on the new Chronicles of Darkness Dark Eras 2 project, which we talked about is now up on Kickstarter that you can go and support. And I had the good fortune to recently talk to her. She is your creator spotlight this week. You can actually follow her at Books of M on Twitter because she tweets about amazing stuff all the time, not only the projects that she's working on, but she's got a great initiative going on this year called Make Art Not War that you can find out more about at her website and also keep up with her on Twitter as well. So she is your creator spotlight. That is going to do it for this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. For Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian LaHenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
Alrighty, and this is Brian here, and I am very lucky this evening to be joined by prolific writer, editor, and game designer Monica Valentinelli. How are you tonight?
I'm doing lovely. Thank you.
Thank you for taking time to talk with me because I know that you are packing for a big convention.
Yes, we are going, definitely going to RobaCon in Finland, and I'm pretty excited. I've never been to Finland before. I am very much trying not to sing the Monty Python song repeatedly. It is very challenging not to do that.
That is super exciting. I've never been to Finland either, and you are a guest of honor at RobaCon.
I am this year. Yeah, it's really exciting.
And this is, did you know much about the con before they approached you to be a guest of honor?
I had heard about it a little bit before, but not a ton. Unfortunately, my convention radar is often limited to whatever I can do in the States.
Right.
So the fact that, you know, and oh my God, there's this convention in Finland and they're like super excited about like gaming and LARP and I get invited to be a guest of honor. That's awesome. So I'm really excited to go.
I know. That's amazing. But it also must create like crunch time for you now because you're prepping for that and you have a ton of projects that you're working on, including the Dark Eras 2 Kickstarter for Chronicles of Darkness, which just got funded. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's right also on the cusp of Gen Con. So this year is going to be a little bit crazier than others because it's the 50th anniversary, so we know attendance has gone up. We know that some badges have already sold out, which has not happened in a long time.
Yep.
So, yeah, there's a lot of levers and pulleys to just kind of manipulate right now just to get through the summer.
Well, and not even just the con, but, I mean, doing a Kickstarter, right? I mean, you're the lead developer on Dark Eras 2, and obviously, there's sort of two major phases of a Kickstarter, the getting to the funding goal phase and then the getting through whatever stretch goals you can get to phase. It's awesome that you guys, with 18 days to go, have hit the funded and are now going towards stretch goals. But as a veteran of many Kickstarters, like, do you feel like you have it down to a science yet, or is it still kind of a fluid thing every time you do one of these?
I feel it's very much fluid, and in this case it definitely is, because we've made some enhancements and changes to Dark Eras. We did not expect Dark Eras to basically turn into a line. The first one was an overwhelming success. I've worked on every project in the Dark Eras line so far. And then when we did this one, we wanted to do something a little bit different. So each chapter is going to feature a minimum of two game lines. So instead of just having, for example, Salem through the lens of Hunter, which is what I worked on for Dark Eras 1, this time we get really cool stuff, like the 1600s with Galileo and Galileo Galilei and the birth of astronomy, and we get Mages and Deviant, which is our brand new game line, and we get the Seven Wonders of the Ancient Worlds with Changeling and Promethean. I mean, there's all these really cool bits that we can do, but it's brand new. So because it's brand new and it's an enhancement to the things that we've done before, we're thinking about, you know, how do we message that to backers? How do we get them to see the excitement that we have for these games, because we are just sitting over here giddy. Like, I cannot wait to go to the library. Like, I'm super excited. I just want to like pull together pages and pages of reference material, because that's what I did before.
Yep.
And it's just so much fun to just dive into history and nerd out over it and then just try to figure out how it fits within these different lenses. So
I love that, because that to me, like, the whole research part of jumping into a project like that, and then, you know, being a creator, you're always asking, like, what if? So you see these sort of milestones, or, you know, places where you can find some footing in events in history or in certain people in history and things like that. And then you can just go off in all of these different directions. And the fact that you're doing two game lines for each era, like, that was the thing that jumped out to me of this campaign, is like, holy crap, that's kind of amazing. Like, I can't think of any other project that did something like that. And that's, to me, is what makes this thing so exciting, is that you're tackling it from two different perspectives with each era.
Yes. And we did have some chapters that explored that previously, but we are making this supplement completely focused on those two different game lines to handle it both from a playability aspect, but also to answer those what if questions. I am joined by Matthew Dawkins and Megan Fitzgerald, who will also be working on the content portion of it with me. And, you know, every thread that we have, we are just so thrilled about the possibilities and the ideas that are just coming up and bubbling to the surface of what we can do. Because there's so many little cool bits of history that you learn about even when you're researching the different eras. I just found out that so I'm going to be developing the 1600s Galileo-Galilei era. And the context on that is that last year I went to a science fiction camp for people, science fiction writers that want to write about astronomy, uh-huh, or have, you know, real world astronomy in their books. And I get to do that in this chapter.
That's awesome.
I'm like so excited about that I get to apply some of the things that I learned from Launchpad. And one of the things that I also learned was that the first known female astronomer is going to be part of my chapter. I'm like totally excited to be able to dive in and be like, yes, here is some of the discoveries that were made, here are some of the politics that were involved. I mean, a lot of this stuff parallels the discoveries that are happening in our world today, in a different context. In our modern day context, more it's about politics. Back then it was more about the church fueling the politics. So, you know, I get to dive a little bit into that mirror and talk a little bit about that in the background section. And I'm just thrilled that I get to kind of tie everything together and maybe get some fans super excited about astronomy and get them looking at the stars.
See, I love that. And I feel like that's it. I feel like that's very on brand for you in terms of like the way that you approach projects, because everything that because I love keeping up with your blog entries. I was reading the update that you had out over on the Dark Eras Kickstarter today about sort of lessons learned from before. And one of the things that I find very inspiring about how you approach pretty much every project that I've seen you be involved in is A, you immerse yourself in it, but B, mm-hmm, it's this constant state of reflection and taking lessons from things that have come before. Like, obviously your work on Firefly and your work in general in sort of lead development you take into a project like this. But what I love about your process is that it's very transparent. Like, you're always talking on your blog or on Twitter or in interviews and sharing that sort of reflective side of the work that you do. And it kind of feels like you're always in motion. And that to me is like super inspiring, because I tend to want to, no matter what type of project I'm working on, really immerse myself. And it's the little details that really kind of hook me and pull me in. And I see so much of that in every project that you do. And it seems like that's kind of your default way of approaching that stuff. And working in the role-playing game world, like, that seems to be a perfect fit.
I definitely try to do it with everything. For me, it's not necessarily just about the role-playing worlds, but also working on existing or established properties. You know, I've done more than the game for Firefly. I did a dictionary last year. Mm-hmm. And we ended up doing a really cool interview with the show's translator, who's Jenny Lin. It was an amazing interview to give more Easter eggs and talk more about the process for the fans. And I've also written a lot of stories in different established universes. And what I feel is that, yes, I am a fan of the properties that I work on. Otherwise, I wouldn't be working in it. But I want to make the things that I make worth people's time and money. So to do that. I love those little Easter eggs myself, uh-huh. like the little DVD extras when they first came out, and you know, all of the hours and hours and hours of footage on the Lord of the Rings movies.
Oh my God. You're preaching to the choir with me right now. Yeah, absolutely.
But I look at that sorts of stuff and I'm like, you know, if I want somebody to spend money on the stuff that I'm doing, I want to make it worth their while. And for the fans that get the Easter eggs, I think it's more valuable for them because, you know, they, and I've had people tell me this, they say, you know, oh my God, you know, you really cared or something like that. But the thing is, I can't fake that. That's just what I do. I do that because I'm also a fan. And because if I didn't do that, I feel like I wouldn't be doing my job, you know, so might as well make it worth their while.
But I feel like what sets you apart, and one of the reasons that I love following your work, is that for a lot of creators, they may immerse themselves in something and they may go through a lot of those steps. But a lot of that times it's behind the scenes, where I feel like your DVD extras you share with everybody. So if people follow your blog, if people follow you on Twitter, if people, a perfect example. I mean, I've followed and backed so many Kickstarter campaigns where the updates are very, just production updates, you know, like, hey, we're this close to getting this done, or, you know, we've got this chapter done or whatever. Anybody can go in and jump into the July 14th update that you just did about lessons learned from Dark Eras 1. It's like that kind of stuff where people are getting a deeper level of insight into the stuff that you're working on. And to me, like, that you do that with almost every project that I've seen, you know, that I followed you working on, you're doing that with. And that's what I love, is that your DVD extras are out there all along the way.
Yeah, I feel like my process as a creator is that it's a journey. And there are so many things that aren't talked about as part of the journey because we focus so much on the successes.
Right.
And I feel like if there's a way that I can give back, maybe that's the way that I can do it. Just so people know that they're not alone. If you are an inspiring game designer, make a game. It's okay. It's okay if you suck on your first game.
Right.
You know, we've all been there, but the thing that helps keep me going was knowing the things that I was going through was normal. And I didn't learn that until I went to BarCon. BarCon being the bar where all the writers and the game designers and then artists and everybody hangs out and then just kind of talk shop.
Yep.
You know, and it takes time to get to know people, and cons are very cost prohibitive. So I appreciate you saying that. I feel like sometimes maybe I do a little bit too much reflection.
Oh, not for me.
But I feel that that's kind of important. And I'm just kind of laughing right now because I have this book that is completely unedited, and it collates the first 10 years of my blog. And it's, unfortunately, it's almost 750,000 words,
yep.
which I'm sure 50,000 of that is code. And I started reading through it, and I was like, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with it. And I was laughing because I looked at some of the advice that I was, because I was trying to be oh so professional when I first started.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to add like little statements to it. Oh my God, maybe I should just tell people I was a complete idiot. I just should never have said that.
You could do like a blog post from then and annotate it now and just kind of go through and write, this is what 2017 Monica thinks of this particular post. But but I love that. Just for the record, I'll buy that book immediately. You can put it out completely unedited right now, and I will be happy to buy a copy of that, because I'm a process nerd. And so that's one of the reasons I like to interview people, right? Is because I want to hear about their creative process, and I love to get insight into that. And again, I feel like you share that stuff so freely. And that kind of ties into, I think, this movement that you've started with the Make Art Not War Challenge, because that to me has been one of the most creatively inspiring things that has come along in a long time. And it's a process that you have been so dedicated to and so out there with and so transparent about through the roller coaster of, you know, trying to stay motivated in a time where it feels like there's not an appreciation of art and creativity, and how, you know, trying to stay positive and stay motivated during that time. To me, that's been super inspiring. So can you just talk a little bit about how Make Art Not War came about and sort of what fueled that for you?
Oh boy. Okay, so there's this unspoken rule with a lot of writers and artists and creatives that if you have a professional profile, you should never talk about politics. There are some people that believe that they think that by remaining neutral, they will not affect anybody in a negative way, and therefore they're going to, you know, put out their best face so that people will buy the work. And I used to be one of those people until two things happened. When we had political strife here at home, and I saw how it was affecting everybody around me, it was so tense. Neighbors were screaming at each other in the grocery store, and that is not an exaggeration. You could not escape politics. There was no place you could go. And it was affecting everybody. It was affecting artists, especially a lot of artists like myself who are essentially self-employed. And it affects your mood. It affects your productivity. It affects everything. And I remembered that, and I was watching out for that, and I didn't want that ever to happen again. That was, to me, one of the worst, most least productive moments in my life.
Yep.
Okay. And then it happened again. And I could tell it was coming because the same things that were happening on a national scale happened on a small scale around me.
Uh-huh.
Because they were using my state as a testing ground for things that they would do nationally.
Yep.
And I'm not talking about specific politics because it's not just about that. We think that politics is this amorphous thing that doesn't affect people. But it really affects people. You know, the healthcare bill, whether you are for or against the changes, a lot of creators are self-employed and they can't afford their own health insurance.
Right.
That's why the original plan was, you know, save so many people, is because that was a vehicle for them to do the thing that they couldn't do. And that's something that we as creators don't talk about.
Right.
That's the reason why there's so many GoFundMes and whatnot. So, seeing that it was going to happen all over again, what I decided to do for myself, and also because I believe in community, I believe that the only way that we are going to be valued as artists and creators, if we start taking care of each other and realize that this is not a competition. The pie is big enough for everybody. I created this movement called Make Art Not War. And the idea was, it started out just 1 hour a day, just do something for yourself and make some art. And then out of that, I've been learning a lot, not only about my own processes, but about other people, about how they view art, whether or not they have support at home. Some people don't. Certainly I didn't for a long period of time. And, you know, some of the concessions that you have to make and some of the shifts that you make. So I came up with an alternate set of rules recently. Every month I have a different optional theme if people want to try to, you know, attach something to it. And there were quite a few people that were like, yes, I'm an artist. I'm here to make art. And then they just stopped. And they learned that too, that, you know, being able to do this job professionally is so different than, I'm going to work on this thing and tinker with it in my spare time, and maybe I'll have, you know, a short story at the end of the year. So it's been a journey, and the journey is not over yet. We just hit month 7, and I am trying to be as transparent as I possibly can about it. I can't make art when I'm at conventions. I really don't like to write at conventions, but sometimes I have to because of deadlines. For example, that was one of the lessons that I learned. And there are a lot of people that are taking it that are touch and go with the things that are around them. But what's come out of it is that it's basically like a little lifeboat. Because if you make this thing that you're doing a priority, and in this case it happens to be art, because art is an artist is what I am as my identity, but also as, you know, as a career, that priority does not change. And with all of the things that are going around us, you feel powerless. You feel like you can't affect change either positively or negatively. You have a lot of friends that are dealing with all this stuff or whatever, but making that art a priority, protecting the art, making sure you keep going, you keep going. I mean, you're going to fall down, but having it there for the entire year allows you to get back up again. And that's something that's been very important to me.
I love that you give people an on-ramp to this process on a regular basis with the monthly themes, with the constant blog posts. You mentioned the life raft. I think that's perfect because that's your – you have established these rules. People go back, and I'll put a link in the show notes to the challenge and rules that you put out in the beginning of the year. And there is a focus on accountability, and there is a focus on setting this challenge for yourself and being able to stick to it. But what I love about what you've done throughout the year is you are always giving people an opportunity to jump back onto the process and to sort of become a part of it. And my favorite thing about this is that it feeds two things. Like as a writer, it taps into my need to, even though things in the world might not be going great around me, to remember that for me, creating something is therapy for me, and not being able to do that and getting away from that is bad for me. And that I feel so much more fulfilled when I am writing and I am doing things like that. But also as someone who didn't start to write until later in life, like I've only been, putting my writing out there for the past, I think, less than 5 years now. And so most of my life was spent as a consumer of art, and books were my lifeline. And mm-hmm. being able to immerse myself in D&D or immerse myself in the world of Dragonlance or all this kind of stuff when I was growing up was such an important place for me to be able to go to, that without that, I wouldn't have become someone who created sort of later on. And what I love is that you're, you know, not only sort of reminding artists that it's important to keep creating, but you're reminding all of us that art is something that needs to be out there, because it's just as important to the people who consume it as it is to the people who create it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the fans become pros all the time, all the time. And the difference between a fan and a pro is, did you sell your work? That's it.
Right.
You know, the minute money exchanges hands, it becomes something else. And then the more you do it, the more you start reading books with a critical eye and watching movies and, you know, being able to pick it apart and whatnot. You know, but nobody can do this by themselves. And I think that if there's one thing that I wish that people would take away from this is that you're not alone. And, you know, if you want to make art by yourself and you want to use this as motivation, that's awesome. But also don't be afraid to reach out to other people who are in the same position you are either. Because sharing that emotional burden sometimes is very important. And really, and I'm just going to say this because it's been coming up a lot. There is no right time to make art. There just isn't. I mean, you either do it when you feel is right or you don't. And deadlines and all those sorts of things are part of the commercial production cycle. So you have to train yourself to be able to meet those deadlines. But whether you start writing when you're 16 or 24 or 42 or 84, it doesn't matter. It really does. The age thing doesn't matter. That's just a perception. Because you can sell at any age. And sometimes, you know, the older you get, the more stories you have to tell. And the more you narrow down and focus on the story that you want to tell. And sometimes that's more important than, you know, trying to basically chase some invisible ladder that doesn't exist either.
Right. And learning creative lessons along the way. And that's why I appreciate your blog post so much, because you're constantly sort of exploring those lessons that you learn and, you know, things that you take into the next project or, you know, incorporating to your own process and stuff like that, because it sort of reinforces that if you are consuming and creating and consuming and creating, you're constantly learning and you're constantly refining your process. Yep. And you're constantly getting better. And so, you know, when you start to put all that stuff together, it starts to snowball and there is this momentum to it that can carry you through times that are really challenging. And so this whole Make Art Not War initiative has been really sort of reaffirming for me.
Good.
And I really appreciate the amount of effort that you've put into it and the amount of dedication that you have to continuing to explore it and talk about it and put it out there for people, because it's wonderful.
Good. I'm glad it's working for you. It actually motivates me to keep doing it. You know, a lot of people at first, they treat these things like New Year's resolutions.
Right.
And it takes 100 days of repetition to learn any new behavior, which is why some people are like, oh, you should write every day. And I'm like, well, that doesn't work for everybody.
Right.
But if you can write for 100 days in a row, then you can train yourself that discipline. And that's, you know, I believe that art can, that more art can really help us navigate through some very challenging human experiences. And the more people that make art, the better.
Well, and just the idea of dedicating time to it, as opposed to thinking about like a word count. Like we hear, especially in writing, you hear so much about them. I'm doing Camp Nano right now, which I love the Camp Nano events because they're much more laid back than Nano proper in November. But I like that. I was just talking to somebody about in our cabin, you know, message board the other day about they were kind of down because they were not hitting their word count or whatever. And we started talking about different ways to measure that process for themselves. And I actually just linked them to your blog post about the rules of Make Art Not War, because there's the focus on dedicating time to the thing that you want to create, as opposed to a particular word count or, you know, like you said before, like the end goal or something like that. Like just the time is what's important, that you're focused and dedicating the time to that. And I increasingly think of my own measurement of my projects in that way, as opposed to getting stuck on a particular word count goal, because those change. You know, there's good days and there's bad days, and there's days where the words flow and there's days where the words don't. But if I'm dedicating time to it every day, that's the important thing.
Well, so word count is interesting as a goal, because part of the reason why professional writers started using it is because books, especially novels and some RPGs, I won't say all RPGs are done this way, but some RPGs are, is that you have a certain, your project is encapsulated by this goal. Your novel has to be 100,000 words. And if your novel is 100,000 words, if you do an outline for your novel, even if it's like a shot in the dark with index cards or whatever, you know that your average chapter length has to be X amount of words. Let's just say 2,500. So then what they do then is, by hitting that word count every day, they're getting through scenes and chapters. Like basically it's micro tasking,
yep,
where you're taking, you know, this very big project and breaking it up into these smaller bits. And for RPG writers, word count can be very valuable, because often our contracts are tied to word count. So this chapter that somebody may be assigned maybe 10 or 20,000 words. Usually RPG chapters are somewhere in that range. So if they have, you know, a 10,000 word chapter that they have to write, and then they know how fast they write, most people not sprinting write between, I'd say, 350 to 500 words an hour.
Yep.
And that's a comfortable pace. So that's how they do it, is they calculate based on math. Well, this is how long it's going to take me to get this done, and this is how many words I need to get down. So then if they miss the time where they don't spend any time writing that day, or they have to go research something, which is a hidden cost.
Yep.
I mean, research is huge, but a lot of people don't realize that, you know, that can take a lot of time out of your writing process, but that's still part of the experience. Then what they do is they say, you know, they look at their word count and they readjust their word count goal to try to get through it. So I am a big fan of the time. I also think that it's important to set aside time for non-productive things like reading outside of your genre, going to museums, you know, looking at things that are maybe related to the artistic experience that you want to do, but try to find inspiration elsewhere. Going for walks is also very helpful. Kind of like the whole, I'm going to pop in the shower for a bit and then you have a big revelation. Walks can be like that as well.
Absolutely.
But I think that's all part of writing. I don't think that just sitting down in your chair, tapping away at the keyboard is just writing. Because you need the, making art is a luxury in some ways, because you need the brain space to be able to think about what you're doing. And that can be challenging sometimes. So that's where the time comes in.
Yeah. And I'm finding lately that my walks with the dog are becoming very good times to let a story idea marinate. And so I've kind of, it changes, you know, different times. Cause with the, my two kids, it's like, as the year goes round and the schedules change and stuff like that, there are different times that have to become that time for me outside of, you know, being able to sit down and write. But the notion of dedicating time to it every single day has really, especially over the last year, been sort of like an anchor for me, which is great.
Awesome.
So yes, very inspired by the Make Art Not War challenge. So again, I'll put a link to that in the show notes for people to check that out. We talked about Dark Eras too. As far as other projects that you are currently working on that you can talk about, because I'm sure there's others that you cannot talk about, I saw mentioned a Scarlands project, which for anybody who has, you know, listened to me talk about my love of RPGs in the past knows that I love the Scarlands. That was my favorite D20 setting from back in the day. So what can you say about that project?
So I did not know about the D20 Scarlands. I was a huge Ravenloft fan back in the day. So my particular fandoms for RPGs were kind of limited to what I had access to at the time. And I'm really sorry that I missed the original, because I got hired to develop some adventures for Scarlands, and I've just been geeking out. Like, you have no idea. I keep talking about how cool this this setting is. Amazing. Like, I want there to be novels and graphic novels and movies and like everything. I just love the concept, and I love the love the idea, and love everything there is to love about it. So what I'm doing is, there was a free adventure for Scarlands to kind of show a little bit about the new rules and the new setting that was released for D&D 5th edition.
Was that the Serpent Amphora?
No, this was the Gauntlet of Spiragos.
Oh, okay, yeah, yep.
So what I'm doing for Scarlands right now is I developed the Dagger of Spiragos, which is going to be released in PDF soon on DriveThruRPG. And I'm also doing the last one in the trilogy, Ring of Spiragos. But what I am doing for those is I am trying to make them interchangeable, so that if you pick up Gauntlet of Spiragos and you are a DM, you can mix and match. If you want to run them in any particular order, you can. Which is turning out to be fun and challenging, and I'm writing a lot of like little notes and Easter eggs, and but I'm also expanding the setting some. I'm working with Scott Holden, who is the line developer for Scarlands, and he's bipping and bopping all kinds of names back at me, and I'm just like, oh my god, can we do this? Can we do this? Just like that little kid in the candy store. Can we do this? This would be so awesome. So I'm having a lot of fun with the last one. I'm working on Ring right now because it takes place in the desert. It's so awesome.
I am so excited about this. And, you know, you mentioned that you started geeking out about the setting, and that what blew me away about the D20 Scarlands when it first started coming out is that it started with this little gazetteer. This Gelspad gazetteer was the first thing that came out for the Scarlands. And then the second thing that came out for it was basically the monster manual of the Scarlands, right, the creature collection, and then the Relics and Rituals, which was sort of the magic and ritual book that came out for it. So it was like all these flavor books, and the campaign setting didn't come until later. And so you had this little gazetteer that people were building stories off of and everything, and then boom, this campaign setting hits, and it's huge, and it's so rich, and it's so... Then all the splat books with the different factions, and then the player's guides and everything. And I can't even think of, outside of like D&D and official like Wizards products, like another setting under D20 that was as well supported as Scarlands was. It was so well supported, and it was so rich, and it was so deep, and there was so many just story ideas for DMs. And I mean, I've spent so many hours thinking about the Scarlands and reading about the Scarlands, so many more than I've ever spent playing in the Scarlands. I did some campaigning in Scarlands back in the day, but just the setting itself was my favorite setting since Dragonlance. which was my favorite setting of all time. And so I was so happy that it was coming back. And, you know, to hear that you are rounding out this trilogy of adventures is awesome.
Well, I can tell you the Dagger of Spragos definitely has some Easter eggs. If you like the D21 back in the day, there is definitely a massive Easter egg in this one. And when they put it in, and I'm not going to tell you what it is because I'm like that, but when they put it in, and I was going through my development pass, I was like, are you sure you want to put this right here? So we had long conversations about how we wanted to broach that particular Easter egg and things that we wanted to do, because this is actually the first adventure that I've worked on where the city is presented as a setting, but then there's this event that happens in the city which essentially changes what the city is like.
Yep.
I think this is the first time I've done that in an adventure, and I remember just my mind was just going off into all these different directions about, oh my God, I can totally see this in a movie and I can't, I just got to pull back. I can't write like 100,000 words here. And, you know, it's always a curse when you fall in love with something so much where you just want to keep writing.
Well, and this has made me dive so far back into it. Like, I pulled out the Gazetteer. I started reading through it again today. I'm like, I'm going back to all these. I'm going to read the novel trilogy again from Richard Myers. Like, it's again, for anybody that, and all these current, all the D20 stuff is available on DriveThruRPG. And then obviously I backed the campaign setting for 5th edition.
Oh, okay.
And I'm probably going to get the Pathfinder version too, just because I'm a completionist like that, but for Scarland stuff. But yeah, what an exciting time for that setting.
Yeah, it's very exciting, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens next with it. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I would totally be down for writing like serial fiction for it or whatever. So we'll see. I've just fallen in love with it so much. I mean, so you know, it's because of this idea that you have these big titans, and then you have the gods, and you have all these factions of gods and different ways of worshiping them and blessings and all the peoples and whatever. But really it's about the lands are exactly as the setting described. They're scarred by these titans.
Right.
You know, there is nothing cooler than having a reason why your land is cursed.
Right. In a recent one, because it happened soon enough to the time that, you know, you're playing in the campaign setting, that it's still kind of raw. Like the scars are, they're almost still wounds, you know, as opposed to scars. And it's just, it's a setting where it feels like there's so much that has happened and is happening and is still left unanswered. And so it feels like in that way, it kind of reminds me a little bit of a Ravenloft or a Planescape, where there is some real solid history to the setting, but there's also so many mysteries and so many things that are sort of still developing that there's so many different ways that it could go. And that was what was really exciting. You could just take a little tiny chunk of this place and tell so many stories with it that you could actually just never leave that one place and you'd be fine.
Yep.
And that's what I loved about it, is you could just take whatever piece you wanted to and dive in. And their supplements did a great job of really fleshing out those little pockets of the world. And so it's super cool. I'm hoping that a lot more people discover it now that it's coming back around, because I felt like it never got the love that it deserved in the D20 era.
Well, the other thing that this setting really excels at for DMs is the unreliable narrator. And what I mean by that is that you could very easily drop in 10 red herrings and have the players go in all these different places, and they would not feel cheated by that.
Nope.
Because that's what this land is. Nobody knows exactly what happened.
Right.
Because they're caught in this basically backwash of, or afterflow, or whatever you want to call it, after all of these events happened. And you're just struggling to make sense of it. So it's, I mean, the players themselves can be very broken as characters, just trying to figure out the best that they can. And it also plays in well with very much with different alignments.
Yep.
You know, you don't necessarily have to be lawful good to to navigate the scarred lands.
For sure.
And those have different effects.
There's a place for every type of character in this world. And that's what's kind of awesome is that. And again, like you said, with the unreliable narrator stuff, I feel like the whole way this world was initially presented fits right into that. Because again, you start with a gazetteer and it's just wide open for interpretation. And then the campaign setting comes. And because so much of it is lore and people's interpretations of what happened, that none of that in any way contradicted what had come before, but it also didn't necessarily fully explain it. And so it's just a cool setting for, like, if people are the types of, you know, DMs that really want to have ultimate storytelling ability, like, this setting just really gives you so many different jumping off points.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I just want to reiterate that Gauntlet of Sparagos is free. So you can go to DriveThru and download that for free.
I will put a link in the show notes to that, too, so people can check that out. And I'll put a link to the Gazetteer, too, because that's just chock full of great starter information for that setting.
That's awesome.
Most of the stuff that people can easily read this, and it's only like 50 pages long, but people could read that and you could do a campaign just off of that.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Really, really good. So I will definitely be following very closely and keeping people posted on your adventures in the Starlands, because that is awesome. So,
yay!
Well, before I let you go, I mean, what are any other projects that you want to let people know about? I mean, obviously people can go to your website, which is booksofm.com, and see multiple posts on a regular basis about the projects that you're working on. And I love that you sort of end every blog post with an update of, like, here's what's out now, here's what I'm working on. But are there any projects you want to get the word out about right now?
So I'm going to have a massive number of releases in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to wrap up a whole bunch of larger projects. I'm the developer for Hunter the Vigil second edition, and I'm trying to push for second drafts before I leave. In addition to that, I've got a whole bunch of stories that I've got coming out in various forms, and if everything goes well this week, then I'll have two very big major announcements, which I'll be very excited about. But really, it's just, you know, right now I'm in that summer slog. For most people, you may not realize just how much Gen Con affects schedules, but everybody pushes to get things done for Gen Con.
Yep.
And then it's like 2 weeks before the show, everybody's like, oh, I'm going to go on vacation now and I'm not going to be around because, you know, that's a lot of work that's coming up. So I'm just going to like bug out for a little bit. I am not doing that because I'm going to Finland. So Finland is going to be an enjoyable experience where I get to do this thing called play games, which I know is shocking. And then when I get back, though, it's more of the hustle. So I hope to have most of my announcements out about Gen Con, but I just want to try to knock a few things more off my plate before I say anything.
Well, I hope that you have a fantastic time in Finland. That sounds like an amazing trip, and I hope you get to play tons of games.
Me too.
That will be a great vacation, and I hope that you'll come back on sometime in the future, and we can talk more about these other big announcements that are coming down the road and other stuff that you have going on. But I will be following everything you do very closely. And again, if anybody's listening to this interview, go check out booksofm.com, read Monica's blog post, because they are a treasure trove of creative inspiration and just process nerdery, as I like to call it. So,
yeah. Can you imagine, Brian? We could have a whole podcast just about talking about process.
Oh my God. That is my dream. Like, DVD extras is literally that's a genre for me. that's what I want. So I'm looking forward to your 750 page book with all of your blog posts.
Oh my God. It's going to be great. It's so ridiculous.
But seriously, thank you so much for taking time on during crunch time for you before you go to this trip to Finland and just chatting about some of the stuff you're working on, because it's amazing. And I will put links in the show notes for everybody to check out everything.
Yeah, and I'm really excited, and I hope a lot of people check out Dark Heirs too. We've got some great people working on this book. It's with Onyx Path Publishing. They've been amazing to work with, and we are very, very excited about this project. And I really, I'm really looking forward to hearing more from the fans and basically just geeking out about history.
Well, and help reach their stretch goals now. I mean, as people hear this interview, there is at least over 10 days left in the campaign, and that's plenty of time to really hit those stretch goals and push this thing even further, which just means...
And vote.
Yes.
Because you get to vote on what's in the book.
What more can you ask for crying out loud? So thank you very much again for your time, and we'll keep in touch, and we'll have you back on the show soon.
Thank you very much, Brian.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.